The Guardian.
Today, Manchester Derby, FA Cup sees United wake up in game you couldn't make up, while City rue Chris Foy's use of company card. Bloody track cyclists, why are they always sticking their nose in? Elsewhere in Cupland, yes we De Canio. Benson edges it for Swindon in the weekend's big giant killing act, except it was against Wigan. Meanwhile, out on his arse from the arse, it's Neil Warnock, a top Hoops fan, reacts. All that plus the latest from Spain and Italy and top French Cup coverage too, in today's Football Weekly. On board today, we have Paolo Bandini.
Hello.
Hi, Paolo. Greg Ruffley.
Hi, James.
And between them, in a kind of hand sandwich, it's Michael Han.
Effortless, James. Effortless.
Thanks for coming in, Michael.
It's a pleasure, James. I know I'm always drafted in when there's big QPR news, so that's once a season.
Yeah, you're a QPR news man. Greg Ruffley, barely able to hold his head up in the pod today.
No, I'm
Liverpool fan. There, I said it.
I'm ashamed.
Yeah. All right, then. Now, we'll talk more about Liverpool and QPR and whatever, Paolo, you want to talk about later on. But we're going to start with the Manchester Derby. Now, bringing it out today a bit. Who's in crisis now? Because City, they're in crisis now. United, I thought, were out of crisis, but Sir Alex tells me I'm wrong.
Refereeing's in crisis, James. That's what's right. that's the crisis that we've got from this weekend's game. I don't know. It was a really entertaining game, actually. I thought it was a lot of people you could see on Twitter, everyone storming immediately that the referee had ruined the game with that sending off, and we can enter into discussing on the merits in a second, I'm sure. But actually, it didn't ruin the game at all. What we got was a really entertaining game, even despite the fact that at one point United were 3-0 up. It was still compelling to the last.
They were 3-0 up. It ended up 3-2. Sir Alex very upset about that. Bottom line is, though, it's the first time City have lost at home since when? December 2010. That's 31 games. So that was impressive, wasn't it?
Oh, it's, they've had an impressive run at home, definitely. I think as much as the game was entertaining because of, you know, despite the sending off, I still think City with 11 men would have made a better go of it, and it would have been a much closer game. Might not have been as entertaining, you know, as it was.
All right. So was the company card, was the red card, was it wrong or right, Greg Ruffley?
I think, given how the interpretation of the rule, I think it's Rule 12, Law 12, has been, referees are now being much more hardline on it, and they have been since Martin Taylor's tackle on Eduardo, because they've said we're not going to accept the lunge anymore in the game, and you can't lunge into a tackle if you win the ball. Now, a lot of people have said, well, he wasn't, you know, I wrote something in the five things.
Any player who lunges at an opponent in challenging for the ball from the front, from the side, or from behind, using one or both legs with excessive force and endangering the safety of an opponent, is guilty of serious foul play.
Yeah, and he was airborne, you know, a good few inches off the floor, and his 2 feet were out in front of him. Now, he took the ball with one foot, and his left foot then came across. But I just think as much as this, you know, he wouldn't have even been booked for it in years gone by in the English game, I think now the referee are clamping down on it, and defenders need to be more clever and maybe learn how to tackle slightly differently than they are doing. You know, I mean, like, he could. There was no real need for him to go airborne in that tackle. I mean, he was over there. He was close enough to Nani that he could have just slid in along the floor, or even just stayed on his feet, as a certain man would say, who's a pundit, and take the ball with a bit more ease than he did. I think there's a lot of posturing, I think, in the English game. You've got to make a statement with an early tackle, and I think, you know, that maybe you don't get as much in other leagues around the world, as Paolo probably knows watching Italian football as much.
I think Greg makes some really good points there, and I do think we need to get out of this mindset where we can only criticise a challenge and we can only say it was a dangerous challenge if someone gets hurt at the end of it, because then you're, you know, of course people are going to get hurt if you're only going to start complaining when they actually get hurt. We have to be consistent on this. Either it's a rule that you can't jump in two-footed or you can. Yeah. But the only issue with this one, I think when you look at the wording of that rule, which you've just read, I think the key words in defence for the tackle there for me are excessive force and the dangerousness of it, because I'm not certain actually. When I watched it, it didn't feel excessive. It actually didn't feel like that sort of reducer, and that's where the
danger comes, though, from being airborne and the fact that you can't control your body weight when you're airborne. There's nothing you can do about that.
Yeah, danger is posed by risk, not by outcome. And I think a lot of people always fail to understand this. Managers, pundits, fans. Oh, if he didn't break his leg, what was the problem? If he did break his leg, he's not that kind of a lad. You know, I mean, it's. I'm with Paolo. Hammer down.
Hammer down.
And I mean, not with both feet, obviously.
Obviously not. Right. Serious problems, though, for Man City,
because already things were looking a bit thin for that cash-strapped club. They've got the Touré's off at the Africa Cup of Nations, and now it looks like company could be out for, what, four games, they're saying.
I have to say, of all the teams to benefit from this, perhaps it could be Tottenham who benefit, because I believe now he misses their game against Tottenham, and obviously it's good news for Tottenham all round if they're short of players at this time of year. It's a bit of a tangent. Greg was going to come in, but there's just something else I wanted to say on the game itself, which was the penalty that made, well, the missed penalty and then follow up that made it 3-0 to United. When I was watching that at the time, I really felt like City's players didn't make any effort at all to follow in when the penalty was being taken. You know, Rooney had a head start; he may well have got to it anyway. But there was at that point of the game a certain despondency about them, and a certain there was a sense, oh well, this has been taken away from us, and now we can't do anything about it. And you know, if they had followed in, if they had disrupted him, even maybe not even got there first, but been enough pressure there to make him dawdle or make a mistake when he was trying to get his shot off, then who knows how it could have gone.
On that amount of money, they should be incredibly professional. But at a human level, you can kind of understand. You're 2-0 down, you conceded a penalty. It is the most wretched weather seen by humanity in 3,000 years. I suspect, yeah, people say their heads were all on the beach. Well, I think their heads were all in the dressing room, weren't they, by the time that penalty came around?
Was the weather that bad?
Yeah.
It wasn't as bad as when I went on the Monday in the league when Liverpool got beat heavily 3-0 on my 33rd birthday.
Right.
Which was really really nice. And it was really icy rain there. There was a lot of wind blowing. It was probably worse than it was at the weekend. But I was going to actually make a footballing point and not just go on about myself. I was going to say, for all that... this is a great win for United against City. Beforehand, I mean, all the talk was about, you know, this crumbling empire at Manchester United and the team's getting older and weaker, and Ferguson, has he got any money to spend? I think regardless of the fact that United won, you could still see obvious weaknesses in the team, particularly in the second half when they're playing against 10 men. Ferdinand was creaking a little bit at the back and misplacing passes and maybe getting caught in possession a little bit more often than he would. When Paul Scholes came on, it was almost... That was kind of a sign that, you know, maybe Ferguson was making a statement to the Glazers that I haven't got any money. You know, he's not actually saying it verbally, but he's saying, I need some money to buy replacement.
There's a question raised by Scholes just generally, which is, Paul Pogba, this player who's been talked up, who's obviously had a couple of impressive cameos and who is supposedly being chased by Milan and Inter and all these teams all across Europe at the moment. What does that say for him if you're bringing back this 37-year-old and not giving him a chance?
Well, it's a question about a load of the players at United. I mean, Joey Barton tweeted during yesterday's game, if I were Anderson, I'd be asking myself what I'm doing at a club that's bringing on someone who's retired before they'll bring me on. Mm. You know, I mean, how must those players feel?
The strangest thing about it is apparently Rooney said the players knew nothing about Paul Scholes coming back until they got to the dressing room, and Paul Scholes is in the dressing room and he's named as a substitute. Now, you'd think if... To bring Paul Scholes back, you thought he'd be in the training for a week with the play, or you know, for even longer than a week, as you would need to get match fit. So to bring him back in, it's more of a statement, I think, from Ferguson than actually, you know, trying to improve the football club. Mm. And I mean, and he was responsible for their second goal, as great a player as he's been in the past. You know, he's obviously going to be rusty coming back in, having not trained.
Still, he got an assist on his first game back. Yeah. I mean, credit to him.
It was an incredible act of stealth. I can't think of another signing quite like it, where someone's been brought in and like nobody ever knew about it. And he was flat. Yeah, I think he laughed off the suggestion in a press conference about a week ago. Someone asked him, "Oh, could Scholes come be brought back?" And he turned it into a joke. So.
It also brings it makes those rumours about United's interest in Lampard look a bit more believable now. Although
you can't see Chelsea surely selling Lampard to.
No, but I mean, last week when supposedly United were interested in Lampard and they kind of laughed it off, the fact that they've brought Scholes back maybe means that Lampard was the first choice old guy to bring in, you know. Who's got Premier League experience. He likes an old guy anyway, doesn't he, Fer? Because he brought Laurent Blanc, he signed, and Henrik Larsson, second part of the season, but I mean, he's a club legend, Scholes.
Well, there you go. Man United still in crisis, is what I'm gathering, despite that victory. City, meanwhile, they just got one win in their last four games. Am I right? And they only have one fit striker and two fully fit central midfielders. And Silva's turned into, well, not Silva anymore. What's happened there? How did they get so thin? How could they have so little cover with all that money spent? It's shocking.
Yes.
All right, then. Okay, well, anyway, they're out of the FA Cup. Although they've got the League Cup coming up, haven't they? Midweek against Liverpool, great.
Wednesday night, yes. Wednesday night they play Liverpool, and they'll be without company for that match because that ban counts. I I mean, I'd say having watched Liverpool last Monday against Man City, I mean, Man City looked incredibly strong, but not necessarily. They didn't look like the Man City at the beginning of the season, which were playing free flowing football. They were more happy to just, you know, kind of contain Liverpool and let Liverpool have the ball, because I think they knew that Liverpool were toothless without Suarez there, and with Gerrard maybe on the bench when perhaps he could have started, as could Bellamy as well. I think with it being a two leg game, I think the second leg is at Anfield as well. I do think that gives Liverpool a bit of a lift, because, you know, over a two-legged game they might think it's a European occasion, and that could help to, you know, motivate the players. But I still think it's going to be an incredibly difficult game because of City's strength.
Will Bellamy play and will Gerrard play as well?
Well, I thought so. I mean, I always think if you've got players who there's a question mark over with fitness-wise, then I always think it's better to start them and see how they go and maybe get a head start and then see if, you know, you take them off, whether the team can hold on, rather than bringing them onto a situation which is kind of beyond getting back anyway.
Mm. All right.
I think Bellamy will start, yeah.
No, interesting game, that one, after the 3-0 the other day. Paolo?
I was just going to return to, I didn't answer that, what you said very well earlier about the lack of depth in City squad. And I do just think it's an issue that keeps cropping up with the Africa Cup of Nations. I think a lot of teams just don't seem to really plan for it. A lot of teams just seem to take this approach that, well, we've got these players and they're good and it's going to happen, the Africa Cup of Nations, so we'll just deal with it. But they're not the only one, City, where I feel like you've seen caught out by that in the last few years, where you've got a player who's that integral to your side and suddenly you're just going to have to do without him.
But also, lack of depth is all relative, frankly. I mean, City's lack of depth does not compare with the lack of depth of anyone lower down in the division. And also, you know, we're talking about Man United having a lack of depth, we talk about Liverpool having a lack of depth, we talk about Arsenal having a lack of depth. Therefore, City's lack of depth in terms of the Premier League race is actually nowhere near as important, I think, as people keep building it up to be. They've still got some half-decent players in that team.
Well, yeah, but at the back, who have they got? Julian Lescott,
England
Savage.
Legend Julian Lescott.
Right, Savage.
One of the most promising young centre-backs in Europe.
Micah Richards.
Loftus-Road, he wasn't. Micah Richards, he's all right.
Yeah, he's all right. Still, that's who they got for the next four games, assuming the company ban is that much. Anyway, well, there you go. Interesting times at City. The draw, of course, does not feature them. It does feature some interesting clashes, including Liverpool-Man United. That's
Merseyside police will love that one, won't they?
Yeah.
Yeah. I just had a feeling yesterday when the balls were going to pop out that it was going to be United, and it was United. And it's an absolute nightmare for the FA, I think, for Liverpool and United both together. I mean, given what's happened with Suarez and Evra and this whole situation that's surrounding Liverpool, this negative press at the moment.
Talking about negative stories, it's not... Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, there's like a negative bubble just surrounding the club at the moment. And the, you know, from a PR point of view, I don't think Liverpool have handled it very well at all. And I do think this offers them an opportunity now.
It does. They can come out in T-shirts with Evra on, something like that.
Possibly. I mean, maybe Evra could wear a Suarez T-shirt himself and shake hands with Suarez.
All right. Suarez will still be banned for this game.
He'll still be banned for this game. But I do think before it, there needs to be these peace talks that supposedly they're going to have. Peace talks. Yeah. Yeah. Peace talks.
That's not over-dramatised.
I mean, apparently they're going to meet in Warrington, you know, in like a midway ground. It's going to be foggy, a lot of mist around and stuff.
I reckon it'll kick off.
Yeah, possibly at Burton Wood Services, yeah. I can... Where's this going? So these peace talks, I do think they need to... It would be nice if they included Evra and Suarez. I mean, as much... Okay, Suarez, you know, he's guilty of racially abusing Patrice Evra, whether he said it once or however many times. They believe he said it more times. And... Evra has also admitted to have been saying some pretty nasty things to Suarez as well. Now, I do think perhaps those two could meet together in a photo opportunity or something just to try and calm things. Although, I'm listening to myself saying this and I'm thinking that's just not going to have any effect on Liverpool fans and Manchester United fans when it comes to the match.
Because they need to be BFFs, best friends forever.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
Just see what I did there.
Yeah. I mean, there'll be 5,500 United fans there because it's a 15% allocation, which is just going to be logistically, a nightmare for the
Great television, though.
Great television, yeah. I imagine ITV will be, you know, making sure they've got no commentary for the first 20 minutes of that one.
You won't need it. But anyway, well, the other big thing in the draw, of course, was the fact that potentially QPR, although it depends what happens in their replay with MK Dons, will be taking on Chelsea. And, of course, that's the big Anton Ferdinand, John Terry thing. And it happens about two or three days before John Terry gets his appearance in a West London magistrate's court, and that's all very unfortunate. And something I don't think we're even that allowed to talk about because there's a court case coming up.
What we can talk about is the fact that I'm sure Michael's not going to thank me for saying this, but the QPR may well not be there anyway, given that they've now gone 16 FA Cup games without a victory.
Wow.
To be fair, we've only lost to one part-time team of car fitters in that time.
Fair enough, Michael. We're going to be talking more about the Super Hoops right after this. QPR then. Neil Warnock out Sunday evening. Michael Han, our go-to QPR guy. Was this a surprise?
Not really. If the sacking were going to be done, I think it had to be done now. Fernandez does say he has money to spend on bringing new players in the transfer window. What is the point of allowing one manager to spend that money if you're in doubt about whether he's going to be there at the end of the transfer window? I think even if there were no money to spend, the game against Wigan in 2 weeks' time would have been a make-or-break game for Warnock. That said, I don't think anyone at QPR wanted to see this happen. The mood on the message boards last night and this morning is of overwhelming sadness. Tony Fernandez has been taking a lot of abuse from QPR fans on Twitter. We all feel a great debt of gratitude to Neil Warnock for what he did for QPR. He took over the club facing relegation after a season in which we'd had three permanent managers and two caretakers, kept QPR in the Championship, next season won them the title, playing at times really, really good football.
So what went wrong?
Yeah. Well, one of the things that made me wonder how long he might last was back in November, before QPR's really bad run started, I spent the evening purely by chance, with someone I'd never met before, but who'd played for Warnock some years ago, who was full of praise for him. Says he's not a tactician. Yeah, he admits that. Has no idea about tactics. He's all about motivation. It set me wondering, first, how some of the players he brought in the summer, at the end of the summer, people like Joey Barton, Sean Wright Phillips, Armand Traore, might respond to that. Because plenty of them would work with managers who are about more than just, up and at them, lads, up and at them! You know, I don't think Arsene Wenger ever bothered doing that very much at Arsenal, for example. I don't think Jose Mourinho was much like that at Chelsea. So I thought, well, how much respect will they have for him? Now, their performances have gone down the pan in the last couple of months. Say, Joey Barton especially, it's a subject of far more doubt from QPR fans than Warnock has ever been. The second thing was, can you get away in the Premier League knowing nothing about tactics? And the thing I think that answered that for me a bit was the two games against Norwich, where both games were won by substitutions by Paul Lambert that Warnock simply didn't respond to. Now, I sit almost next to the home dugout at Loftus Road, and after Lambert's substitutions in the game on 2nd of January, like when Norwich won with a late goal, Clint Hill came running over to the QPR bench screaming, you've got to change it. It's 5-4 at the back now. They've got on wing-backs. You've got to change it. The players recognised the need for change. Warnock kind of stared off into the distance. Nothing happened, and Norwich scored again 2 minutes later. Now, I know that's one anecdote from a two-minute passage of play, but it seemed quite telling at the time. The players knew something had to happen. Warnock didn't.
All right. And how did the supporters feel about the advent of Mark Hughes?
A lot of moaning and groaning on the boards, but I think Hughes would be okay.
Right.
I think he'd attract stronger players than Warnock would probably be able to. For all the huffing and puffing about his record at Fulham, where everyone says it was only player power that did a job for them the season he was in charge there, his record strikes me as perfectly reasonable.
He did well at Blackburn as well.
He did well at Blackburn. He did well at Wales as well, yeah. Which people forget.
I mean, you're buying him for his signings, I imagine, of how good he is in the transfer window as well.
Yeah.
And you look at some of his signings at Man City, and they are still there or thereabouts.
And at Blackburn, yeah, Chris Samba, who's a target of ours anyway, he's Hughes is the man who brought him to Blackburn. I mean, he's got an eye for a reasonable bargain when he hasn't got too much money to spend, actually.
And he wanted to move north as well, so that's, what, 4 miles, I think, from...
Yeah,
Craven Cottage.
Yeah, no, it's not quite that far, but you know, you're much handier for the M40 to get onto the M25 or maybe M40, M6 if you want to go north.
Right.
I was reading something on Mark Hughes just before we came in here, which is just a Sabotage Times article. It sort of was an amusing observation it made at the beginning, which was that Hughes' career almost feels like it's gone in reverse. It feels like he started off as a national manager, then went to the club where he made his name, and then he went down, then he went on to the next step where he was doing trying to work things out as I go along at City and Fulham. I think the only thing that's I guess would be a slight, I don't know, alarm bell or whatever you want to call it for me would be, when he went to Fulham, part of the problem was that he showed up basically treating the job like he was too big from it from day one, and that was what rubbed a lot of people up the wrong way. And I just don't know if he's maybe feeling a little bit more humble about the situation now, or if he would have the same attitude towards QPR as, oh, well, this is just another stepping stone back on my path up.
Imagine the silent phone for the last 5 months made him a bit more humble.
Yeah, I would hope humility would have entered into it now. But the other thing is, who else is available, frankly? Yeah, Goose Hiddink. Come on, we're dreaming if we think Goose Hiddink is going to go to Loftus-Road, I would have thought.
Sven, I don't know why you're laughing.
Not Sven.
No?
Benitez wants another job in.
Oh, I'd love to watch the scintillating football play by Rafael Benitez at Loftus-Road. What a joy that would be.
Right. Sorry. Well, 2 points from the last 11 games, is that right?
2 points from the last eight league games.
Yeah, right.
There was a very difficult run through autumn. Yeah, when we had Spurs, Liverpool, Man U, Man City, Chelsea. Got 3 points against Chelsea, of course. So no one minded losing those games. It's the losses to Norwich, the failure to beat, the loss to Sunderland. I think that was a crucial game. Half time on that game was the first time the QPR fans actually started booing. Not lots of booing, but you know, there were isolated boos around the stadium at half time, and you thought, he's really got to buck this up. This performance, frankly, isn't good enough. Yeah, even with a much less gifted set of players, the performance would have been good. It wouldn't have been good enough there.
Hmm. All right then. Well, there you go. It does look like being Mark Hughes, but that's not official yet. Meantime, moving back to the FA Cup, you were doing the clock watch, Paolo, on Saturday. How was that?
The joy that is attempting to simultaneously report on 23 games, of which you can see two.
Right. Which two could you see?
I could see the Macclesfield Bolton game, which at least was probably of all the games to choose, if the 3 p.m. kickoffs on Saturday afternoon, it might have been the one to choose simply for that spectacular Mendy goal.
Yeah.
And I could also see the Fleetwood Blackpool game.
All right. That was nice.
Yeah. A little blast from the past. FA Cup football being played at Highbury.
Lovely.
Not that Highbury.
But Highbury.
Yeah.
There were some great goals. You mentioned the Mendy one. We didn't throw any particular love for Danny Welbeck. That was an amazing goal, wasn't it?
Brilliant goal. Wonderful goal.
The best goal this weekend, Ben Arthur.
The Newcastle against Blackburn.
Yeah, Newcastle against Blackburn. Yeah, I mean, it was a fantastic goal. He picks it up 10 yards inside Blackburn's half. And he had maybe two or three, well, it's probably in front of him, there's maybe about six players, and he kind of went on an angled run towards the right-hand side and then cut inside really sharply. And then he had this burst away into the box. And then there's about three players who were around
him. That's the thing. It seemed like he beat more than an entire team. I wondered if they were going around the back and coming back in again.
Possibly, all having a go, yeah. And then he kind of did a little step over, dragged it with his right foot over to his left and then really whipped it in really quickly with his left foot.
It was like a greatest hits medley. You've actually linked to it on your five things we learnt about the FA Cup.
Yeah, we had someone phoning sick yesterday, so we had to do our five things ourselves, and I was a bit lazy with that one, I've got to admit.
Well, who normally does them? Do you source it out to somewhere in kind of Asia?
We'd bring someone in from a global perspective. I linked to it, and it was a fantastic goal, so you could have a look at the blog before the FA take it down.
Nice one. All right, there you go. Now, what else from the FA Cup? Fewer upsets, just to sort of sum up. Fewer upsets, is that fair?
I think that's one of the points made in the Five Things blog, wasn't it? That there were fewer Premier League upsets, but actually a lot of the Championship teams seemed to drop off against slightly lower seeds sides. But obviously we did have the one fantastic upset.
The Swindon-Wigan one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I suppose fantastic upset. There would be those who would question whether or not Wigan were a giant to be killed if they wanted to be.
Canio definitely thinks they were a giant.
Fourth-tier Swindon beating Premier League Wigan.
No, I mean, that was just the obvious joke that's been made. But it was a 53-place gap between the two teams in the league pyramid. It is a spectacular result, really.
Right.
Wigan, had changed nine players, but you still would expect them to be able to put out a side strong enough to win that game. And what was great about it, actually, was it wasn't... See, in the end, the winning goal was offside. I think that's the one thing you do have to say. But actually, it wasn't like Swindon had in terms of play, just come and tried to nick a result. They actually played
Robin
really
Tadden
attractive. Indeed.
In a very real sense. Di Canio calls it the best moment of his life, as has been widely reported. He also called for... He says, I know that normally you only do this when you win something big, and I'm not necessarily saying to put up a statue, but even something small like a plaque with all the players' names on, because they have done something special. It's lovely, isn't it? Of course, back in Lazio, he would have had plaques put up when they won the derby. They stick a plaque up on the wall and that. But it's interesting because, I must admit, I haven't been keeping a close eye on how Paolo's been doing.
He's
down
there. He's been great entertainment down there, hasn't he?
Well, it started off on a bit of a rum note with that bust up with one of the players.
Yeah.
And then he was on loan from QPR at the time.
Right. Then, there you go.
Then he accuses players of not going down enough in the penalty box. So said,
really?
You know, yeah, said, you know, sometimes they're getting tackled, they're getting fouled in the penalty box and they're not going down. They need to go down more often and only then will we get what we deserve, you know. So he's, you know, it's quite, it's bringing a refreshing kind of viewpoint to the game. And then there was that moment when he turned up for the fun run, the 2 mile fun run to start it in his full Swindon kit, and set off on the 2 mile fun run, ran the wrong way, and then realised he was on the half mile route. The half marathon route, and ran the whole half marathon in about 1 hour 45 minutes or something, which was only about half an hour off the winner. So, and he didn't stop all the way. He said very proudly at the end.
Wait, did he showed some running as well at the end of this game, joining his players on the field and a terrific celebration.
Is he refraining from bringing his robust political views to bear in Swindon as well?
That's the elephant that was sitting quietly in the corner of the room until now. But that's the question, is it? Is it okay to enjoy Paolo Di Canio? It's a tricky one. I was wrestling with this last night. I've met him on various occasions, and I've never seen him behave badly to anyone. In fact, he's always been very friendly, and he's a terrific guy in football terms.
I remember interviewing him years ago, and he was incredible fun. That was before the fascism.
Right, well, it was before it got mentioned.
Yeah.
It's a thing, isn't it? Because, you know, he does have these deeply uncomfortable views. Now, he would say, I'm not a racist, and he's spent a lot of time in this country. He's clearly in this country now, and he's, you know, mixing with people all creeds and beliefs and that. But when I asked him about this on the one occasion I, you know, dared to bring it up after he just showed me the tattoo of Mussolini's helmet across his back, not that helmet. But what he said was, no, that he believed in certain beliefs about family, honour, you know, the kind of old-fashioned values, traditional conservative values.
He got the trains running on time defence.
Yeah, that kind of thing. Those are the values he shared with, you know, the old Mussolini government. It's a thorny question, that.
Maybe he's been educated since he's been over here, you know, maybe to be fair, way of living.
He'd been over here for quite a long time before he wrote his autobiography declaring his support for Mussolini. Mm. He'd been in, you know, ethnically diverse East London.
Now, part three begins in cracking fashion with the return, long awaited, of Sid Lowe in Spain. Sid!
Hello, James.
Hi. You're in Madrid.
I am in Madrid, yes.
Yeah, but you're doing a blog about the World Player of the Year.
Well, I will be later on, yeah.
Oh, okay, cool. Because that's happening at the moment.
You know who else is in Madrid, James, on that very subject?
No.
It's a sort of trick question.
Ah.
Cristiano Ronaldo and Mourinho are both in Madrid.
Right. Okay.
They're not travelling to Zurich. So in case you were in any doubt whatsoever that they know that neither of them are going to win their awards, neither the coach award nor the player award, that's a little bit of your evidence. I think it's a bit petty, to be honest, but there you go. Real Madrid do have a game tomorrow, which is their formal excuse for not going.
Is it just that Cristiano Ronaldo is still so depressed he can't leave his bedroom?
Well, he managed to leave his bedroom to play for Real Madrid at the weekend.
Yeah, but then he refused to celebrate his goal because the fans were having a go on that.
It's very, very interesting as well, and the way that the reaction has been from the Madrid media this morning, both Marca and AS, which of course are the two pro Real Madrid newspapers that have reasonably close relationships with the club, and certainly there are bits of the relationship which I think are, frankly, pretty pathetic. But they've both run stories on him today. One of the papers running a story essentially saying, you know, what's the matter with him, but everyone's going to support him. And the other one effectively, Cristiano Ronaldo asks for support. He wants people on his side. He doesn't want the fans whistling him and getting frustrated with him when things aren't going well. And as you say, he scored on Saturday, which is the fifth of five. So I suppose you could argue that in the 89th minute, the fifth of five doesn't really matter. But he was a little bit kind of downbeat about it. And a couple of players spoke about it after the game. Sergio Ramos said, well, we know what Cristiano is like, and that's absolutely fine. It's not a big deal. And Marcelo too kind of pointed out that you know, Ronaldo possibly wasn't that happy. Neither of them really revealed very much. He just said, well, that's just kind of the way it is.
So no word as to what's getting his goat.
Well, I think what's getting his goat is quite simple, really, that he was struggling during the game and missed two or three chances, was probably a little bit wound up by that. When the goal came, he was probably thinking, oh, well, at last, there it is. But rather than relief, I think there was almost a sort of irritation about that. And then we say that I think he feels that off the back of the Clásico that perhaps he was attacked a little bit unfairly, and I think he'd probably be right about that, and that maybe he didn't get the degree of support that he believes he should have. I think actually in a way that there is a worrying trend, which is now that there's a belief that players have to be backed by the media all the time, and as soon as they're not, everyone jumps up and down and thinks the media is against them. And in Madrid, nothing, certainly the same is true in Barcelona, nothing could be further from the truth, but even the slightest critical voice now is treated as somehow some kind of, what's the word, aberration, a kind of not one of us sort of attitude.
In the meantime, plenty of things to put a smile on Real Madrid's faces collectively. For example, the fact they're now 5 points clear after Barcelona were held to a 1-1 draw by Espanyol.
Yeah, and didn't Espanyol fans enjoy it? Draws are the new defeats, as I've said to you lots and lots of times, because of the sheer number of points that Real Madrid and Barcelona rack up. And Barcelona have now dropped points, which are really quite significant. They've only been beaten once this season, Barcelona, but they've already drawn 5 times and been defeated just the once. Now, put this into context, 5 draws, 1 defeat. Last year, in the whole of the season, they had 6 draws and 2 defeats. Barcelona really are in a position now where they can't afford to drop any more points. But Madrid could win the league now, losing at the Camp Nou and winning every other game, which I think is not very likely, but it's plausible at least. That 5-point lead, I think, is massive given the sheer number of points these two teams pick up.
Right. Well, you mentioned the Espanyol fans. I enjoyed their Qatar is not Catalonia banner.
It's a good one, that. Yeah.
Espanyol,
an interesting club because their identity has shifted over the whatever it is 110 years or whatever it is of their history, and they really now, I mean, their identity is fundamentally, obviously, in many ways being we're not Barcelona, but now that is kind of it's kind of expressed in a sense of we don't like the fact that Barcelona dominate the, if you like, the Catalan environment, the Catalan state, and they feel Espanyol, I think, almost like a resistance force in Catalonia, and that was very explicit in that banner, and a couple of other banners were as well picking up Barcelona, including one that used the Barcelona phrase, Barca's more than the club. The banner said, Catalonia is more than a club.
Ooh, that's good, that, wasn't it? But there was some rather nasty booing and monkey chants at Dani Alves, though.
Yeah, and I don't know. It's impossible for me to make a judgment on how Alves should react. Of course, it's entirely up to him. But he, after the game, said, "No, I didn't hear it, and it's not a problem." Which is a pity because you would almost like him to say something. Not very much has been said in Spain, but there has been a little bit. One of the Barcelona directors, Toni Freixa, last night on Twitter during the game, described it as lamentable, and it was very, very loud, and it was every time that Alves got the ball, and I thought it was. I thought it was much, much clearer than it tends to be. I mean, every now and again you get pockets of chanting, and sometimes you think, have I heard that right? But I think last night it was absolutely clear.
Well, see, the other thing of interest, Diego Simeone returning to Atletico Madrid now as manager, and what, he kicked off with a 0-0 draw at Malaga, yes?
Yeah, El Cholo Simeone. He said he was very, very pleased. The team showed solidarity and commitment and togetherness, and they were defensively very strong. I think that's only partly true. They were a bit more aggressive, perhaps, but that may well be the impact of a new manager, of a new manager. We've got the normal thing of coach comes in, everyone says, oh, we're working fantastically hard, and this is a new start. And you look back at the statistics, and I think it's since 1987 that the Gil family took over Atletico Madrid. Diego Simeone is the 49th managerial change since then, and all of those managers can't all have been absolutely rubbish. So I think Atletico Madrid have an issue to deal with, and it's not the coach. The coach may have been a problem, but it was not the problem.
Give me those numbers again. What was it? The 47th?
Since 1987, when the Hill family took over the club, Simeone is the 49th managerial change. It hasn't been 49 coaches because some have been there twice, three times, even 4 times, but they've had 49 managerial spells. Since 1996, I can't remember the managerial stats, but since 1996, when Hill's son took over, in other words, and also the last time they won something really big before they won the Europa League, they've averaged 14 new players a year. I think it's summed up actually quite nicely by Ron Atkinson, who I think was at Atletico Madrid for 93 days, and as he put it, he probably deserved a testimonial for that.
Yeah, although there's another man we're not sure if we can laugh at. But there you go. Sid, thank you so much for joining us with that today. And look forward to catching up with you on Thursday, perhaps, with any big transfer news, if there's, you know, is there anything happening?
Yeah, I don't think there'll be a huge amount, but the financial crisis in Spain is huge in football now. I don't think there'll be very many transfers. What there will be by Thursday, of course, is some Copa del Rey, and we're on course for another Real Madrid-Barcelona. Barca 4-0 up after the first leg against Osasuna. Real Madrid 3-2 up after the first leg against Malaga.
Excellent.
And if they both get through, they face each other. Did you just say excellent?
Yes, excellent.
I think that's terrible, isn't it?
All right, it's the only two clubs I know anything about, so... Yeah,
you,
it's in my comfort
zone. You and the
whole
of the Spanish media, James, sadly.
Sid Lowe in Spain. In France, Paolo, Philippe Auclair was teasing us last weekend with... last Thursday with the talk of the French Cup, and it happened, and there's all sorts of excitements there. Joe Cole, with his first ever hat-trick of his career... Who was it against, Paolo? Chantilly.
I was about to say, Chantilly, because there were puns being made on Chantilly and getting the cream and all that before the podcast started.
That's right. All that great material that never reached the listeners. Never mind. But anyway, they're what, fifth tier of the French game, are they? Something like that. I think that's right, isn't it, Greg?
Yeah, I think they're the sixth tier.
Sixth tier?
I read yesterday.
I know that PSG's opponents, Lokmin, is that right? Lokmin, they're from the sixth tier. And they only just, PSG, they only just beat them. 92nd minute, Diego Lugano goal, sparing Carlo Ancelotti's blushes. Who were you watching this? There was Simon Burnton downstairs was saying Carlo just stood on the sidelines in what was his official debut, shouting, Jouez, Jouez.
Which means play, doesn't it? Play.
Yeah.
Play. Yeah. It's a great way. I mean, it's very much with Neil Warnock kind of management. You know, maybe they should have just got Neil Warnock to PSG instead of Ancelotti, if that's what he's going to do.
Yeah. Well, I think that's, you know, probably only the beginnings. You know, Carlo Ancelotti, he learned English.
Oh, yeah.
He'll learn French.
We've got a lot of love for Carlo here. He's a fantastic manager.
All right, then. Now, let's finish off today's pod with a tip-top roundup of what's happening in Serie A, which also returned this weekend. And, pal, a big story would that be Inter, who were not so long ago on the brink of relegation, roaring back up towards the top now with their fifth straight win.
Yeah, fifth straight win. I think it's now 7-8 as well. There's a stat which I now can't find in front of me saying they've in those eight games of which they've won seven, they've scored 16 goals, although when you think about that, if they scored five
much.
In this game, it's not that many, is it? It was an impressive performance against Parma. I mean, they really did blow them away, but there was also that slight reservation that I think you get sometimes when a result is that one-sided, which is, well, how much are they playing well and how much are Parma playing awfully?
Right, and Franco Colombo, the Parma manager, resigned after this game.
Not confirmed yet. But
oh, is it not?
I don't believe so. I think it's expected in the next 24 hours that he's going to be... on his way.
It's the first time they've won five in a row since the time of Jose Mourinho, and widely acclaimed as Inter's best performance under Claudio Ranieri. A lot of players coming back in. Maicon looked back to his best for the first time in ages, set up a couple of the goals, and Ricky Alvarez looked fantastic.
Yeah, and that's obviously very promising for him, because he's been a player who I think a lot of hope was put in at the beginning of the season, and he'd taken a while to settle. But I wasn't sure if that was the story of the round. I mean, actually, it was one of those rounds where a lot of the teams that you expected to win did win. There were a lot of them won quite emphatically as well, but in the end you had Milan won, Inter won, Juventus won, and Roma won. So the only team and indeed Udinese won, who are still in third place. The only sort of big team that really didn't win was Lazio, who got absolutely hammered at Siena and seemed to be falling apart. But actually Napoli's win was the one that sort of stood out for me, because they haven't won away to Palermo in 43 years. So a 3-1 win and perhaps sign that they're finally beginning to wake up and show some league form as well.
A fantastic goal by Edson Cavani.
Yeah, there was a few fantastic goals in that game. Actually, Miccoli's header, which the consolation goal for Palermo, was a super header. And actually as well, Cavani set up the first goal, which was a Pandev finish from close range, but I thought it was a really super turn to get away from the defender after Gargano put it into him.
Will they sell Cavani? Will Napoli sell Cavani?
This is a question that keeps getting asked, and in the end, I can't really answer it, because the point is that De Laurentiis does not need to sell to anyone. He's got him on a good good length contract, and he's a man who's got money in his pockets. But if City come in and say, here's 60 million euros, then, well, he might say, I think I can do better. You know, I can do better things with that money than I can with Cavani. But actually, I've heard the thing I meant to say on Inter before, which I didn't say, was it was quite interesting, because before before the game, they were actually getting a lot of stick in the Italian media because they only came back from their winter break on, I think, the 2nd of January. And every other team had been back sooner. You know, Milan and Juventus were off having these tours in Dubai, and there was a criticism actually saying that, oh, well, Inter aren't taking this seriously. You know, they've had a difficult first half of the season. Why aren't they showing more intensity? And Gianpaolo Pazzini came out and said, well, we've actually made a decision that amongst the players that we're going to impose a fine on ourselves if we don't start playing more like Inter in the second half of the season. So if we lose this game, we're going to fine ourselves. And it seems to have worked out pretty well.
Well, there you go. Are Inter going to sign Tevez?
So the situation at the moment is that both Inter and Milan have a bid in for Tevez. Adriano Galliani has obviously been photographed having a lovely lunch with Tevez and Jurabchian in Brazil, in Rio de Janeiro, which suggests that Milan have a much better situation in terms of the player and in terms of what he wants to do. And that seems to be the understanding, that he would prefer to go to Milan at the moment. The reported figures for what has been offered is that both teams have offered now a loan until the end of the season with no longer a right to buy, but an obligation to buy at the end of the season, with Milan's figure reported today at €24 million. They're offering at that point, Inter supposedly offering €25 million, which I suppose it sort of sounds a bit petty, doesn't it, just going €1 million over. But actually, €1 million is still a lot of money, isn't it?
Is it? I suppose it is for some people, yeah. Okay. The other thing is the fans. A lot of talk, and in fact, our message boards was almost entirely dominated since last Thursday by a discussion of the wrongs and rights of the Blackburn fans. I don't know what your view is on that, Michael. Are they right to boo and abuse Steve Keane? But just looking at what's been going on in Italy, it does seem like small beer. I mean, Fiorentina, all sorts of problems there after their, Mihalovic got the hook, and Delio Rossi's come in.
And they won the weekend won. As well, and it's very hostile atmosphere. Yeah, there was a few pointed banners this weekend as well, because at the Juventus game, Marco Borriello's been signed from Roma. He's actually a player whose scoring record hasn't been so bad over the last few years. He's a player you would imagine they would look at and think, well, he's a like-for-like replacement for Matri as a substitute. He's a player who can contribute in a season where they're obviously still unbeaten. They're going for the title. But very unimpressed response from the fans, who had a big sign-up saying...
Borriello, a mercenary without dignity or honour. It's a hell of a way to get greeted by your new fans, isn't it?
And the other one was at Atalanta, who obviously Cristiano Adoni is involved in this match-fixing investigation at the moment. And for a long time, they were totally supportive and refused to have a bad word said against him. But it really seems to have changed the mood there now. And there was a sign-up which... says, we are and remain for a healthy football. No favours, no fixes. Doni with us, it is finished.
Yeah, Doni Judas was another one. Well, he basically admitted, well, he had this extraordinary comment where he said, yes, I did it, but I did it for the benefit of Atalanta. Which is an interesting viewpoint, but that story is going to run and run. As you were saying before, that's a police investigation. It's going to take forever.
But a good win for Milan there as well, by the way, because Atalanta hadn't lost a game at home this season. So.
Yeah, Zlatan looking in fine form as well. He's having the season, isn't he? Well, there you go. Greg, I know you're bursting with questions about Serie A. Now's the time to get them out.
I'll save them for next time, James.
Then, fair enough. Michael, anything you wanted to throw at Paolo here?
Not question-wise,
right. No. Okay. Excellent stuff. Well, that brings us to the end of today's extra special Football Weekly. We'll be back on Thursday with an extra special Football Weekly Extra. So do join us for that. Bit of League Cup semi-final roundup, bit of a look forward to the weekend, all that kind of thing. For now, it's a big, big thank you to Greg Ruffley, Michael Hann and Paolo Bandini, producer Ben, and you, the listener. And we'll catch up with you on Thursday. Bye-bye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.